This is the Real World DevOps Podcast, and I'm your host, Mike Julian. I'm setting out to meet the most interesting people doing awesome work in the world of DevOps, from the creators of your favorite tools to the organizers of amazing conferences. From the authors of great books to fantastic public speakers, I want to introduce you to the most interesting people I can find. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of these are available as open source and as a hosted SaaS solution. You can check all of it out at InfluxData.com. My thanks to Influx Data for helping make this podcast possible. Hi, folks. I'm Mike Julian, your host for the Real World DevOps Podcast. My guest this week is James Turnbull. You probably know James from his seeming inability to stop writing technical books, such as Monitoring with Prometheus, The Art of Monitoring, the Terraform book, and like a bajillion others. He has also worked for some pretty neat companies too, like Puppet and Kickstarter and Venmo. And now he works at Microsoft, leading a team of CTOs in residence. Welcome to the show, James.
Hi, Mike.
I'm really curious, like, what is a CTO in residence?
I guess my primary mission is to make Microsoft relevant to startups, much the same way that Microsoft is shaping its relevancy towards the open source community. We're also interested in looking at other audiences that we've traditionally not been involved with, and startups is one of those.
Gotcha. And you're just leading a team of people that are focused on that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so most of my team is people who have come from startups, or and particularly from engineering management leadership roles in startups. One of my colleagues was the CTO at SwiftKey, and another one, fairly famous, Duncan Davidson, who wrote Tomcat and Ant, and has been around engineering management for a long time, and folks like that who really are here to help sort of startups understand a bit more about how to grow and scale. I think some of the big challenges startups have are actually not technology related at all. They're really about, you know, how do I build a recruiting process? I had 10 engineers last week. I have 100 this week. How do we structure the team? So we've sort of brought together a group of folks who have fairly deep experience in those sort of problems for startups, and have sort of a deep empathy for the startup community.
Yeah, that's quite the task ahead of you.
Yeah, look, I think Microsoft's traditionally been known as an enterprise software company. You know, a lot of startups are not sure of their relevance to us. I think increasingly we're seeing traction to cover. Is one is that obviously Azure is one of our focuses, and the cloud platform in there. And that platform is looking more broadly at not just enterprise audiences, but other groups. And secondly, for a lot of startups, Microsoft's deep in the middle of most of their customers. So particularly if you're a B2B startup or something like that, and you're trying to sell into enterprise business, Microsoft's been doing that for 30 years. They have all the connections and account managers and sales folks and multi-million dollar relationships with some of the people you want to be customers with. We can provide you with some of those connections, but also a lot of advice and expertise about how to sell to those customers. And having worked at both Puppet and Docker, you know, a large part of my job was attempting to sell, you know, as a small startup, as a fairly early employee at both, into big companies. You know, you can't walk in the door at a Wall Street financial if you're a 30-person startup in Portland, Oregon, without having a pretty credible story. So I'm happy to sort of help startups do some of that messaging and understand how to have some of those conversations.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things about my own company is my clients are all these large companies too, and I'm a 2-person company. But selling into a very large company is nothing like selling into a small company. Everything works differently. People think about their jobs differently.
Yeah.
I think maybe my most favorite thing of everything you just said is this isn't your daddy's Microsoft. The Microsoft we all grew to know and hate is not today's Microsoft at all, not by a stretch. And that's just absolutely incredible to see that turnaround.
Yeah, I got a LinkedIn request from somebody yesterday, and the message said, you know, I've read a bunch of your books, you know, I've used a bunch of the open source things you've worked on. I was really surprised to see you at Microsoft. I was like, okay, this could end badly the next couple of sentences, because I've certainly had a few people of my generation who remember the bad old days and Linux is a cancer and things like that. And he finished with, you know, it's really interesting to see companies grow and change. And I was sort of like, wow, okay, that's I thought that was going to go really badly, but, you know, that's right. I think it's a fairly accurate reflection. I think Microsoft is aware of the fact that this is not a position that was pragmatically not a good business position to be in. The world is changing. It's moving towards the cloud. You know, the stacks in people's companies, the way they manage things, the infrastructure, the software, you know, things are changing. And I hesitate to say this conclusively, but I think open source won. You know, this for certain values have won, given recent sort of events with the discussions about large corporates and their contribution to open source. But as a technology choice, it's pretty clear to me that open source won. And I'm kind of a bit smug about that, to be honest.
Speaking of your books, I would just straight up say you're the one that got me into monitoring. And you kind of did this unknowingly. Like we hadn't met until a couple years ago. But in 2006, I guess it was, you released a book called Prognagius 2.0. And at the time, I was working for a very small private school. And someone said, hey, we've got like these couple hundred printers and they keep going offline. And like, you know, we should probably know when that happens. So I'm like, well, I don't know how to solve this problem. So I start Googling around, find this thing, Nagios, and then find, oh, hey, there's a book on it. So I bought the book, and like that, I learned about monitoring that day. I like that's the Prognagius 2.0 is what got me into that. And this whole time, like I kind of started my career, which was really cool. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. I think I said to you before we started, I feel like apologizing too, because it's I can't remember anything that's in the book. And I think that it's probably acting as a monitor stand for a lot of folks. And I'm pretty sure that my ideas about monitoring were very embryonic. But I really appreciate that. That's always exciting to hear when someone actually is like, this was really helpful or that was really good. Because as an author yourself, none of us are ever going to be John Grisham, right? We're not in this for the money. And those conversations where someone reached out and said, I read your book, it really helped. Or even if I read your book, it didn't help hugely and here's why, I'm like, that's awesome. I'm glad somebody got something out of it and had some feedback. And anyone who's listening who has ever had the urge to tell me what's wrong with things or what went well in a book, my email is easy to find. Feel free to shoot me an email. Always happy to chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Like one of the things that authors don't get very often is feedback, both positive or negative. I really expected to get a lot of hate mail for the stuff I wrote in my book, and it just didn't happen. I was very disappointed.
I actually think that it's interesting. I was thinking about your book the other day, and when we exchanged some emails, and I think your timing was very good. I think people were waking up to the fact that monitoring was evolving. I think that what you had to say was not only very timely, but for me, it solidified a bunch of different ideas that I had previously sort of, you know, I could talk about in abstract or, you know, in a siloed sort of way. I think the first couple, I strongly recommend people should read the first couple of chapters of your book.
Those were my favorite to write.
Yeah, they are one of the better summaries I've read. I guess more modern monitoring.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah, well, it's a topic that I think you, I, and about 200 other people in the world care about, but we all do it.
when I was, I'd tell people, hey, I'm writing this book on monitoring, their first response was almost invariably, have you read The Art of Monitoring?
Like, oh, well, oh dear.
I really think that I would set out to write a book without having read every book on monitoring there is? Like, yeah. That I'm somehow unaware of one of the most popular books out there? So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to have James do a blurb on the back of the book and solve that problem forever.
that was a good plan. I was looking through my Amazon history the other day when I was doing my taxes. And I can tell when I'm working on a new topic because I've literally bought every single book on that topic. Not just for writing a book, but like I'm I was. I decided the other day that I should. I gave Rust a stab last year, and I didn't get a chance to do anything with it. And I thought I'd give that a stab again. And I thought, oh, I'll buy a couple of books and see what they're like. And so I can see the pattern of here's some Rust books, and then a few years ago here's some Go books, and a few years before that here's every book about monitoring, which is not actually a large portfolio, but there's enough of them around.
It is much smaller than people would think.
I bought a bunch of books on. Around the same time as like on systems theory and stuff like that, because I was struggling to find adequate ways to talk about monitoring as a construct. And I realized that the maturity of the vast majority of the conversations out there, you know, there's on any technical topic, there's sort of like, I look at the very bottom of the pile, there's a Hacker News post with a comment thread on there. It's like the worst case scenario. And then there's like a few Stack Overflow answers. And then there's maybe a detailed blog post that gives you an explanation of how to use something. And then maybe there's somebody having an opinion about design or the language aspect of some language. And then there's like a computer science-y, like some of that thought about things document. And monitoring is very heavily stuck at the blog post end of that spectrum.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like when I was trying to find higher level thoughts on it, they're just not there. The conversation, I think the level of conversation has started to shift in the past couple of years, and that's awesome. Like I really want to update my book now because of all the stuff around observability coming out has changed the conversation dramatically. One of the interesting things is I never even used the word observability anywhere in my book.
Yeah.
Like people weren't talking about it that way. So I didn't talk about it that way either.
Yeah. I was having this conversation with Baron Swartz, who makes software for database observability and database monitoring. And Baron is super smart and sort of very much more a computer science person than I am. I realized that there are a bunch of stuff in his way of thinking that he was one of the handful of people that had taken commentary about monitoring and observability further than just that scratch of the surface sort of thing. And he's another person who's thorough. I thoroughly recommend. There's a couple of short O'Reilly things he's written and his blog post, that are really interesting sort of reading from I learned stuff that was sort of more high level and useful and overarching than I had previously seen.
So I want to shift topics a little bit. You and I were talking before we started recording about DevOps. And I will start off with a very provocative statement. DevOps is dead. What do you think?
I think I agree. I was involved in very early days. I was trying to look up before when I wrote my first blog post on DevOps, and I think it's like 2008 or 2009. I think I went to the second DevOps days. I didn't go to the first. I think probably... And I take some responsibility for this because I worked for a company that sold a DevOps tool. But I think the first time a marketing person described, categorized DevOps as being about tools, and B, used it as a somewhat abstract marketing rallying cry rather than a cultural statement, that's when the first knife was sort of stuck into the entity, as it were. And I think... Yeah, I think I would agree now.
Tell me more about that. Like, what do you mean by that knife going in? Like, is it really that marketing killed DevOps?
I'm being unfair on marketing there. I think it's probably a factor. To me, DevOps was almost nothing about tools. Tools were enablers for folks doing DevOps things. To me, the big thing about DevOps and the thing that really struck me when I first started thinking about the concept is that I've been doing engineering things for 25 years now. I feel really old. A significant part of the scars that I have as part of those experiences are being on either sides of the conversation, being the developer of a bit of software or the operator of a bit of software, where I've been in conflict with the other party because, we either didn't talk about how they built it, or they didn't understand the environment that they were deploying it into. And most of those conversations happened at 3 o'clock in the morning on a conference call where management is screaming at us because some mission critical piece of infrastructure is down and they're losing money. And to me, that was a really scarring experience. And to me, DevOps was about solving that problem. It was about having conversations with the people we work with and going, you're building this thing. Here's an idea of what it looks like in production. And by the way, can we make sure that we do this, this, and this to ensure that we care about security and monitoring and backup and recovery or whatever it happens to be, and create that sort of bridge between those two disciplines in which really hasn't existed for most of my career.
Yeah, I completely agree with all that. What do you think about SRE? Like, has that changed things? To me, I feel like SRE is also kind of a marketing label.
Yeah. I know a lot of people out of the Google SRE organization, and I deeply respect the work that they've done. Yeah, and it's definitely there are definitely a lot of solid ideas. In the SRE book is an example of responses to the SRE book were very polarizing. Let's put it that way. It was very polarizing. I quite liked
it. That's a very polite way of putting it.
I quite liked it, and I thought it was really useful. What I'm really sad about was it that it wasn't published in 2005.
Yeah.
When it would have been actually life-changing to a bunch of people, a bunch of us who worked in the sort of high-volume, high-value, web-facing world. But the SRE program at Google is a solid platform. Not everything applies to everybody. The classic refrain of, you're not Google. It needs to be reemphasized a few times. Not everybody has Borg. Like there's definitely a flavor to it, but I can't deny the fact that a part of the reason it was released was definitely as a marketing aid to Google's recruiting in the SRE organization. And there's nothing fundamentally wrong with that, but it needs to be acknowledged as one of the origins of that movement.
I observed a conversation happen recently in a Slack where someone released a series of articles, fantastic articles, and they were referring to an important measurement as a KPI. And someone responded, it's like, why didn't you call it an SLI? It's like, well, because an SLI is something that essentially Google came up with. We've been using the term KPI to mean important metric for, I don't know, decades. And the term SLI is less than 10 years old.
Yeah. This is one of those things like the every generation reinvents the past, right? I'm going to say something controversial here. I look at the way Kubernetes is configured and I look at the sea of YAML files that I'm expected to poke my way through. There's some tooling around that. And I'm like, did we learn nothing from the horror that was configuration files? I mean, it could be worse. Somebody argued me the other day, it could be worse. It could be XML. But I'm like, so I could be stabbed in the front and the back. But it feels very, it feels weird to me that we, there's a bunch of lessons we haven't learned and a bunch of things that we have reinvented the wheel about. So, I'm not really fussed about the terminology people use. I'm not even fussed about sort of recognizing that there's a past history there, except to hopefully learn from it. As long as people take it on board and go, in the case of SLIs and KPIs, it's like you have a customer, they have a measure of how successful they are. That should mirror your measurement of how the functionality of your infrastructure or the thing you look after for them. And if they have that sentiment, I don't care whether they call it an SLA, an SLI, or a KPI. Yeah, I think debating about that is a funny one.
So you mentioned that the sea of configuration files in Kubernetes, which is absolutely wild. Like, yes, it's like we didn't learn anything at all. That brings me to, do we even need DevOps anymore? Like, on one hand, we're still making the mistakes that we used to make. On the other, things are very different than they used to be.
Yeah. I think there is no yes or no answer to that statement. I think it's a bit more nuanced. Obviously there's a bunch of things we haven't learned. I overheard a conversation at a KubeCon a couple of years ago, where two fairly, I will say, 20-something looking engineers were talking about the fact that it would be so much easier if there was some sort of templating system for YAML configuration. It would make so much easier if we could build templates and stuff. I have no hair anymore, so I wasn't pulling my hair out, but I was mentally doing it. Don't say anything, James. You'll look like an old fart. Like, just turn around and walk away. Go to the bar. Have a quiet drink. Definitely we need to we should learn from the things that came before us to make the experience of the people maintaining these systems at least as good as, if not better, than the experiences we had. But that being said, Kubernetes is an example of how far up the stack we've moved. You know, back in the day, I spent a lot of time worrying about Linux kernel modules and package management systems and IP tables and stuff like that. To a large extent, those are not skills that are relevant to a lot of contemporary engineers who are working on, say, container-based systems, because that's all black box to them. It's taken care of underneath the covers. For good or ill, that they're running a Kube cluster on top of a machine that they may not even maintain or may not even know anything about. So, perhaps some of the problems we had in the past might not exist anymore, perhaps. I don't know. Never been a huge fan of black boxes either. So
it seems to me that we have moved some problems around. Like, some of the problems are still there. We just don't see them anymore. Or we've made them someone else's responsibility. Like, when, say, Amazon or Azure, pick your cloud provider of choice, I don't have to care about the network anymore. Except I kind of do, but it's an entire black box to me. So when something is kind of hinky, I can't really do anything about it anyways.
Yeah.
So there's that whole discipline of network engineering that has, where a lot of systems people were also amateur network engineers are not anymore.
Yeah. I think there are, the argument the cloud providers make, and I think it's a reasonable one, is that economies of scale apply not just to cost, they apply to stability and availability, and in the vast majority of cases, the 80-20 rule applies and you don't need to care about the fabric between your infrastructure. In the cases where you do, like, let's say I'm a high frequency trader or something like that, where I care about every picosecond between me and the pipe out the building and me and the trading floor, yeah, maybe you're not running in a cloud, right? Like, maybe you're running on custom built high performance machines with incredibly tuned kernels and network stacks. Does everybody else, need that? Probably not. But you're right, it does make debugging more complex,
right,
and potentially problematic.
So I think all that's pretty interesting. And there's also something you mentioned before we started recording about Puppet. Puppet, Chef, config management in general, significantly less relevant than it used to be. I remember that my last full-time job, most of the work I did was writing Chef and Puppet. Like, there's a whole lot of orchestration and config management of, like, how do we build a system? And now, like, as far as I can tell, no one's really caring about that anymore. Like, we have, the problems have moved further upstack.
Yeah, I agree. And I've been saying for a few years, and I think if I look at some of the work that's come out of there, some of those companies, and HashiCorp too, to some extent, the important thing about configuration management is the lessons learned about configuration management.
Right.
And that the fact that the abstraction has moved up up the technology stack should be like, how do we apply the lessons we learned managing infrastructure level components and managing application and service level components? Mm-hmm. Orchestration is not a solved problem by any stretch of the imagination. Things like microservices make things considerably more complex. Obviously they're very flexible in many ways, but all of a sudden you have 300 little services that talk to each other via various ports and require different levels of security and AAA, that require different pieces of configuration. Like, this is a non-trivial problem. And guess what? We've actually solved some of these non-trivial problems before. Why some of these companies hopefully will reinvent themselves a bit in that space. And I see a little bit of that happening now. We'll just see who survives, I guess.
Right. I have a few last questions for you. Of the bajillion books you've written, which ones have been your favorite? Like, what was the most interesting one to write?
I think it's probably The Art of Monitoring. There's a lot wrong with that book. And a significant amount of it was that
I went into
an obsessively deep hole, and I wrote a 700-page book, which is very focused on a technology stack to articulate what is effectively a change in thinking. And I did that because everyone had a conversation with, I was like, who's going to buy a book about the theory of monitoring? But people might buy a book that has like configuration files and technology and shows you how to do things. Maybe that'll work better. And of course, I realized that I would have written a much shorter book and probably not have spent a year and a half of my life buried in complex configurations if I had have written a theory of monitoring book, and it might have been quite timely. I think it's probably my favorite book, but it's also my least favorite one too. And there were some terrible. I brushed over some topics that I probably should have covered in more detail, and there's a couple of. I recently found a calculation error in one of my graphs that a Russian PhD student pointed out to me, and I was like, huh. It's not a big miscalculation, but it's enough that I felt embarrassed, and I went back and discovered that I'd done an R calculation wrong, an R formula wrong, so there's moments where I'm like, how many people saw that and thought, what an idiot is this? So that's never good for
me. I had that happen recently with mine. My book is being translated into Japanese right now, which is super cool. And the Japanese translators are thorough.
Okay.
They have found so many errors and so many like typos, but some of them are calculation errors. They don't fundamentally change what I'm talking about or the illustration, but it's one of those like, I really did screw up an average calculation.
Yeah, I did that too. In this case, it's a percentile calculation, but yes. This Russian PhD student was hilarious. He's like, I just don't understand how you got this number. And there's no spreadsheet, there's no R formulas in there, there's just like a graph. And he's obviously smart enough to look at the graph and go, that's wrong. And he was very polite about it, but he was genuinely thought I might have discovered a new branch of math as opposed to me making a terrible mistake, which I thought was both flattering and horrifying at the same time.
Absolutely. So I noticed there's a trend with how you write books. To me, looking from the outside, it's you start writing on a topic right about the time it hits mainstream. Whether that's true or not, that's how it seems to be. So what can we look forward to next from you? Like, are you thinking about writing any new books?
I am contemplating it. I've had a long dry spell of just writing sort of bits and pieces for internally. And I'm writing a bunch of content for Microsoft right now. I'm thinking about writing something again, something technical. I feel like maybe service mesh is probably somewhere in this space that I'm interested in. I don't see anything in there yet that sort of resonates with me as a solution I want to write about, but I think that's a space that I'm going to watch. I would love to write a book about startup engineering practices and about engineering leadership.
That could be fun.
But I think that I've been beaten to it. Camille Fournier wrote The Manager's Path, which is to me, I every time I read it, I'm like, I can't do any better than this. This is an awesome book.
It is a very good book.
And so I feel like that position has been taken, but I've had some thoughts about like the lean startup and things like that. Like, I think there's definitely, we're definitely in a different era, and there's definitely some lessons learned. And, particularly things around topics like work-life balance and ethics and diversity and inclusion, where an update to some of the seminal ideas about startup, the way startups work, might be welcomed.
Mm, yeah. All that sounds great to me. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Probably the easiest place, is Twitter. I'm one of the dying generation that uses Twitter. So my Twitter handle is @KARTAR. If you're interested in my books, Turnbull.press is my grandiose imprint and that sort of lists all of the topics, the books and the topics and so forth. And that's probably the easiest way to find me.
James, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
You too. Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you to everyone else listening to the Real World DevOps podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcast. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.